Jeff, alcoholic. I wasn't nervous until Tyree started reading the traditions. I have a friend named Bob Olson, and I asked Bob one time if he ever gets over being nervous, and he said, yeah, I stopped that a long time ago, but he said, I have a really good prayer for you to use when you speak. And I said, great, what is it? And he said, I always say, God, make me useful above all else, even if it makes me look like a fool. I said, Bob, that is the worst goddamn prayer I've ever heard in my life. It's a terrible prayer, and I'm not going to use it today. Wow. Thank you, Harlan and Zan, for asking me to come here. It's an honor and a privilege to be at Seaside today. And a guy named, and I want to apologize to the committee and to everybody here, a guy named Jack Quarterman taught me about the responsibilities that a speaker has when he comes to a convention, and you go to all the meetings and you meet all the people. But my father is really ill, and you guys were very generous and considerate and allowed me. I came in late last night, and I'm going to lead this afternoon, because my dad is slipping away, and my sister's been taking care of him, and it's been it's hard on her, and I need to be there for them. But last weekend, I was over there, and my dad, he was really vital up until about a month and a half ago, and then something happened, and we've just been losing him day by day. And it's getting crazier and crazier. And last Sunday I was over there and he was talking about he was back in the Navy and he was on a submarine. He was never on a submarine and he didn't know who my sister was, and he was just getting wackier and wackier. And we're standing by the bed, and finally I said to my sister, I had to go speak at this place in Toluca Lake. And I said to Mel, listen, I gotta go home and clean up and suit up. And my dad goes, oh, are you speaking? Like he was. That's the one thing he remembered, you know. And maybe that's because we're a family that was put back together by Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm a real alcoholic. I like hard liquor, I like hard narcotics, and I like guns, and I like to get them all going at the same time. And anything goes. And wherever we're going, it's a good idea if you bring a gun too, because there's going to be some trouble. And it's bad, and but I don't like telling my story. My story sucks. I'm really sick of it, and I used to be somebody who I used to say that the laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous kept me in the rooms, and maybe when I was new that was true, but it's not so true anymore. And now, what keeps me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous are the stories. The story is about when the desperation in you reaches out to the God in another person, and you put one hand in God's hand and one hand in her hand, and your life is forever changed. That's what I love. That's what keeps me here. And my favorite AA story is not mine. I was in, so I'm going to tell it. Well, I'm funny right away today. This no sleep thing's working out, Don. I was in a meeting in a guy's living room a few years back, and it was a little tiny, he had lived in this little condo, and he crammed 14, 15 people in this tiny living room. And there's only one decent chair in the whole room, and the speaker got to sit, and there was a lady sitting in that chair that night. And I'd never seen her before that. I haven't seen her since, but I hear about her from time to time. Her name was Monica. And Monica was this young, successful, attractive, upwardly mobile woman living in New York City. And she had a boyfriend, and he was hot, young, and exciting, and he was making money, and they went to all the good clubs, and they went to a lot of parties, and they drank good booze, and they did good drugs, and they did all that stuff, and they were having a great time. And one day, she woke up, and she looked in the mirror, and she didn't like the person that was looking back. And she went to the boyfriend and she said, you know what, I'm feeling things I never wanted to feel, and I'm doing things I never thought I'd do. And I can't live like this anymore. So I got to find a way to stop. And so they talked it over and they decided that they'd get married and buy a place, and then everything was going to be okay. So they got married and they bought their own apartment in New York, and a few months went by, and one day she woke up and she looked in the mirror and she didn't like the person that was looking back. And she went to the husband and she said, I'm feeling things I never wanted to feel, and I'm doing things I never thought I'd do. And I don't know who's looking back at me in the mirror. And I'm uncomfortable with the things that we do and the things that happen to us. And I got to find a way to stop drinking. And so they talked it over, and they decided that that they were going to get pregnant in that way. She wouldn't drink because she was pregnant, and he wouldn't drink because she wasn't drinking, and everything was going to be okay. And then the day came when she was 4 months pregnant, and she was hanging onto that guy's leg, and she was begging him not to leave her, because she said, if you leave me, I will drink myself unconscious one more time. And I'm 4 months pregnant, and I want to be a good wife, and I want to be a good mother. I want to take care of this baby more than anything else in this world. I don't want to drink, but I cannot stop. Please don't leave me. And he shook her off, and he went out, and he slammed the door, and he didn't come back. And one more time, she drank herself unconscious. And she woke up the next day on the floor, and she pulled herself together, and she was sick, and she was scared, and she was tired. And she stayed in that place all day wondering what to do. And the only connection she had to Alcoholics Anonymous was somebody had left her a little meeting directory. So that night she pulled herself together and she got dressed and she went out into the night in New York City to find Alcoholics Anonymous. And she didn't know how to read that dumb thing with all the symbols on it. I can't read it. And she went out and she found the nearest address, and there was a church, and there was some stairs going down into a basement, and there was a little sign outside, and she went down those steps into the basement. And there in that basement, sitting in a circle, were 25 or 30 men. And there was an empty chair, so she went and she sat in it. And she's looking at them, and they're looking at her. And the leader said, screw it, and he read the preamble, and then he said, who wants to go first? And she didn't know that she wasn't supposed to share in a men's stag, and she didn't know you were supposed to raise your hand and get permission. And so she poured her heart out to these 25, 30 strangers. And when she sobbed herself out, it got really quiet. And one of those guys stood up and said to the others, gentlemen, this is the reason we're here. And nobody tried to sell her anything. Nobody tried to date her. Nobody told her to put the plug in the jug. They told her to come back. And they talked that night. They talked about the disease of alcoholism. They talked about the peculiar mental twist. They talked about the steps. They talked about the book. They talked about God. And they talked about the miracles that they'd seen in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told her she was welcome to come back. And she came back every night, every week, for about a month and a half until they said, Monica. We love you. But we weren't sure you'd come back. And there's a sheet of paper, and there's a list of women's names and their phone numbers, and they're all dying to hear from you. And we will always love you, and we will always care about you, and we will always be here for you. But you got to get with the women, because they will save your life. And 18 years later, everywhere Monica goes, people know that they don't have to die of alcoholism. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not always the one that I find, and it's certainly not. I don't want to give anybody the impression that that's the one I always represent, because it's not. But that's the one that I fell in love with. And that's the one that saved my life and changed my life when nothing else could. And I didn't always feel that way. I went to my first AA meeting in 1968. I was in a place called Wayside Maximum. I was waiting to go to court on a drug beef. I was 18 years old, and I already knew about the morning drink, and I knew about coming from behind, and I knew about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And alcohol already ruled my life. It kept me from going to school. It kept me from going to work. It kept me from going to court. It kept me from doing anything. All I could do was go to jail. And that's the only time I was ever sober or clean, was when I was in jail. And I went that night just to get off the unit. They asked who wanted to go to AA. And all I remember about my first AA meeting was there was three winos in the front and two drag queens in the back, and I'm somewhere in the middle. And that was my introduction to A&A. And I left that place, and I turned 19 years old in the reception center in a prison called DVI in Tracy, California. I turned 24 years old in the alcoholism program in the Camarillo State Hospital, where I met my first wife, by the way. It wasn't a total loss. And 10 years after that first meeting, I came crawling back into Alcoholics Anonymous at the old Radford Clubhouse in North Hollywood. And I went there that day at Christmas time, 1978, not because I thought I was going to get sober or because I thought somehow this time it was going to work. I went there because I had no place else in this world to go. And I went there, and a guy stopped me, and because I went in that room and I looked around and I see everybody's plugged into something I'm never going to plug into. Everybody's feeling something I'm never going to feel. I don't belong here either. And I started to walk out, and it was a guy named Bob Kay. And Bob ran over to me and stopped me. And Bob never Bob never, ever once spoke in a quiet voice, except for, I think, that day. Because that day, in the gentlest voice I ever heard that guy use, this is a guy that was 86th, Alabama 86th and from the clubhouse, because he knocked a newcomer out in the coffee room one time. And Bob, I didn't think Bob had a quiet voice, but in a quiet voice, Bob said to me, "You know, where are you going?" And I said, "I got to be somewhere." And he said, "No, you don't." And he said, "You know, whether you believe it or not, there are people here that can show you another way to live without booze and without drugs if you just let us help you." And because I had no place else to go, I said, "Okay." And he put me in this in a 12-step house. And I sat in that 12-step house for 3 days. And I'd never been sober 3 days in my life unless I was locked up somewhere. And I knew it was only a matter of time before I hit that liquor store and got some of that Ernest and Julio's pink swill in a bottle, and I'd be off and I'd be living in my beat-up car, or I'd be living in North Hollywood Park, and I'd be back doing the things I always did. And I went to a noon meeting, and I heard a guy talking about sponsorship, and I went back to Chandler Lodge, and I started thinking about a guy that I'd met around there named Don Morgan. And Don was the kind of guy that had a courage that I didn't understand. And I didn't know how to put my fingers on it or put a name on it. But this was a guy I'd been to, you know, in those first few days, I'd been to, they used to have a Tuesday night meeting there. And the Tuesday night meeting was called the beginner's meeting at Radford, which was an oxymoron because no beginner ever shared there, and I'm pretty sure none of us ever went there. But people would go up there, and the purpose was that other people would get up with time and would talk about their experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And we were supposed to listen. But, and I remember this, it was a weird meeting, and it wasn't that well populated or attended. And they had a podium in Radford like this, and it was on a stage like this, and there was a light that shined on it. And I'm going to get back to my sponsor in a second. But so there was a light that shined on it, and you could smoke in the clubhouse in these days, and they had those crappy aluminum tin ashtrays. And I remember this lady was up there that night, and they had this stupid cat that lived in the clubhouse, and the cat would jump on the podium, and people would pet it and smoke, right? So, and this lady's up here talking about God knows what, and then she goes, "I don't know how it works, but it does." And everybody claps, you know, like that was something. And that became like the topic. And I'm thinking, what does that mean? And then she calls on a guy, and he gets up, and he goes, "I don't know how it works, but it does." And everybody laughs and claps. And then a third person gets up, and this lady goes, smoking that 120-millimeter cigarette, petting that stupid cat. "I don't know how it works, but it does." And everybody laughs. And then they made the mistake of calling on Don Morgan. He got up there, and before he even said his name, he picked up that big blue book, and he said, "I know how it works. There's a whole chapter in this big blue book called How It Works. Any of you fuckers ever read it?" And and they never called on Don in that meeting again. And even though I couldn't put a handle on that, I knew that that guy stood for something. I knew that that guy stood up for something and put his neck out there for a message he believed in. So I called him that day and I said, I had 3 days, but I wanted him to think I was serious, so I told him I had 53 days. If by some miracle I stay sober, I'll clean it up around 9 months or something, right? So I call him and I said, "Don, this is Jeff Kelman. I'm in Chandler Lodge. I got 53 days. I'm really serious about this A&A thing this time, and I was hoping you'd be my sponsor." And he thought that over for about a split second and said, "Jeff, there is no way in the world I would ever be your sponsor." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because I know you, and you think you're something that you're not. And if I was to say yes, I'd be your sponsor, I'd spend the next 2 weeks taking you to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, reading you the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd talk about God, and I'd talk about the steps. And I introduce you to people that I look up to. And 2 weeks from now, you're going to tell me one more lie, and then you'll disappear. And I will have wasted all that time I could have spent with somebody who really wants this program. And I don't have time for guys like you." So I sniveled, and I pleaded, and I begged, and finally said, "Okay, but don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor until I say it's okay." It's a God's honest truth. And he said, "Let's talk about the steps." And I said, "Okay," because I thought, "Well, that's going to take a while." And he said, but he was like, he was into action. He said, "Usually I like guys to read the big book, and sometimes we read it together. And when it tells you to make a decision, you make it. When it tells you to do something, you do it. And the first time you don't, I'm not your sponsor." And I said, okay, because it sounded like it took a long time. And then he said, but you don't have that kind of time. I don't think you have that option. I think you need to get into action right now. Let's talk about the steps. Step one, you are one. Step two, you better hope so. Step three, you called me, you just made the decision. And when we get together next time, this was a Thursday, when we get together on Sunday, I'll explain to you what that means, and we're going to get down on our knees, and we're going to hold hands, and we're going to read that prayer. I'm going to show you where it is in the big book. And then he said, do you have some paper? And I said, yeah. And he said, write this down. And he told me about the four columns. And he told me what to put in the columns, and he told me to start writing my inventory that day. And he said, if I got stuck, I could write fear on the top of a piece of paper and start making a list about my fears. But that the next Wednesday was going to be inventory night at his house at 7:30, and I needed to show up with my inventory. And so the next Wednesday night, I show up at his house, and I got this stuff written down. You know, I tried to get out of it on the way, too, because I heard some other professional newcomers. I called them in the middle of the week, and I said, listen, Don, you know, I'm dredging up a lot of heavy feelings on this inventory thing. And it's slow going, so this may have to happen in God's time. And he would say, oh, good, God's time is Wednesday at 7:30. I'll see you at my house. And he'd just hang up. I'm listening to the dial tone, you know. And so I get out to his house, and I want to talk about packing guns and kicking people downstairs and going to jail and getting in bar fights and all that stuff that we tell each other when we're locked up together. And he was so unimpressed. We were sitting in this one room, and he was sitting on this low, like a bent seat or something. There was a TV on here. And he used to leave the TV on, and he'd pretend like he was contemplating what I was saying. But I could see he was watching TV. And the second night, I'm pretty sure he dozed off for a couple of minutes, and he'd stop me in the middle of this stuff, and he'd go, Jesus Christ, are there any honest feelings in here? And I go, yeah, one's coming up, I think, And I didn't get the whole honesty thing. I thought we were just talking about the bad stuff that we did. You know, or the stuff that we wanted to brag about. And he'd stop me in these things, and he'd pull on his face to stay awake. And I remember one time about most of the way through the second night, I could tell he wasn't having a good time. And he stopped me, and it was one of those things where he said something that I didn't know what it meant, but I knew it was important. And he said, you know, Jeff, if you look around the world, it's 90% takers and 10% givers. And then you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and guess what? 90% takers and 10% givers. Which one are you going to be? And even I know the answer to that. And I said, well, I want to be a giver, Don. And he said, then you got to have something to give. You got to have this change in your life. You got to have that dramatic and total psychic change. You got to get right with God. You got to shake hands with the real Jeff Calnan and stand naked in front of me and in front of God. And then at some point, you're going to have to go back out in that world and stand up there and make amends to people that you've hurt, used, and abused. And that kind of action takes courage. And there is nothing about you that tells me that you're ever going to show me that kind of honesty or that kind of courage. So either you get honest and you get busy, or we're done. And man, I used to go back and live in that halfway house, and I'd look around when nobody was looking. I'd get down on my knees and ask God to give me the courage to tell Don the truth about the real Jeff Calnan. That guy made me write 5 inventories until the day when he stood up and put his arms around me and welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that day we did 6 and 7, and he promised me. I barely got out of high school. I'd been arrested a couple of dozen times. I'd been in the hospital 6 times. I'd been in the ER I don't know how many times. And he promised me on that day that everything that was impossible for me as a hope to die, wino dope fiend, 2-time loser, would become possible through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I would do God's work and do it well, anything was possible. And he used to play me tapes of guys like Sandy Beach that used to say, and you know, we'd go to conventions and we hear guys like Sandy and Jack Brennan and Franklin Williams and Norm Alpe. We love Norm Alpe. Man, we followed that guy. Norm lived not that far from us, and so we used to call his wife every week and find out where he was speaking, and we were on fire for AA. And if he was speaking in Costa Mesa, we'd drive to Costa Mesa, and we'd get there an hour early and help you set up the chairs. You'd be wondering who we were. But we wanted to have the first row because we knew his pitch by heart, and sometimes we'd chime in and he'd tell us to shut up. It was the greatest. And Norm used to tell the same story night after night, and he used to get to that part where he'd talk about being in that first meeting, and he'd say, They laughed that night. They laughed because they'd been miserable, and they cried because they were happy, and they called it AA. And in those, man, guys like Norm Elpe made me proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did all those things, and we had panels to juvenile hall, and we formed our own clique, and we got our own posse, and we had all our own newcomers, and we used to fill the car full of guys and go to meetings and conventions. And here are the giants of the day. And we had role models. The God that I taught my children about, my three kids, I learned from Bob Uro. And there were just so many. I'm not saying it's any different now, but I just loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life just opened up. And at a year sober, I ran into that gal that I met in Camarillo, and we got married. I ran into an AA, what a coincidence. And we got married. But 2 years sober, we had a little girl. And And around that time, a guy asked me to go to this place and told me to go see this guy and ask him for a job. And they don't let guys like me in the door of this place, but I went over there and this guy gave me the job. And I think, you know, me, Mr., barely got out of high school, never been to college, always been in trouble. And now I got this job and I think I found that thing that maybe I was meant to do. And my life just took off in amazing ways. And I worked really hard. And the harder I worked, it seemed like the bigger my life got. And I still was active in AA, and I went to places and I found you. I went to meetings in Hong Kong. I went to meetings in Ireland. I went to meetings in the Virgin Islands. I went everywhere. And every 3 or 4 years, they'd call me in the front office of wherever I was working, and they'd give me a bigger job or somebody would hire me away. And every 5 or 6 years, I'd go out and buy a bigger house. And every 7, 8 years, I'd go out and get a younger Mrs. Calnan. And I just did that over and over and over again until the day came when I got this great big life and a great big job and a great big career. But the bigger my life was getting and the bigger my career was getting, now it seems like the smaller my program is getting, till I got this great big job and this little tiny program. And as it got, and like I said, as I got busier and busier, I don't think about it, but I'm backing out of Alcoholics Anonymous one judgment, one inconvenience at a time. And at first, it's just because I'm busy, and I never stopped loving Alcoholics Anonymous. I never stopped loving you. I never stopped loving AA. I never stopped thinking about it. But I'm doing less and less and less, little by little, like little tiny grains of sand. And I don't remember taking a cake for 16, 17, or 18 years. I know I took one for 19, because a guy that I'd sponsored for 18 of those years lived in Roseburg, Oregon, and he drove 900 miles to give me that cake. And that's the only reason I went to that meeting that night. And after 19 and a half years, I go to meetings and I start to realize that I can barely make it to the break. I'm not comfortable sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know something's not right. And I'm engaged to the future ex Mrs. Calnan number 3 and a half, and we live in this gigantic house up on a hill. And every room has a view, and we got fancy friends and cars and motorcycles and you name it. And I'd be driving up the hill, and I could remember what guys like Norm Alpe and Eddie Regan and Bobby Earle and Larry Blake and Jack Brennan used to say. They used to say, if you put anything in front of God in your sobriety, you will lose it. And I know something's not right, and I know I'm living in fear, but I'm not feeling like taking a drink, and so I think I just got to get a handle on it. And by the way, at 19 and a half years sober, I don't know how to pick up the phone and call you and tell you that I am scared, because I'm the guy. I'm the guy that makes things go. I'm the guy that talks at the conventions. I'm the guy that makes the money. I'm the guy that takes care of this. I'm the guy that does that. And about 3 months prior to what would have been my 20th birthday, we were out of the country, me and this fancy fiance. She's the youngest, prettiest, craziest one yet. And she's got all these fancy friends with heavy Eastern European accents and fancy cars and no visible means of support. And we're in this resort out of the country, and they're all drinking, and everybody's happy and relaxed and funny, and I'm sitting there like a stiff, and I'm just locked up. And finally, I just couldn't take it anymore, and I leaned over to her, and I said, give me one of those. And she didn't know the real Jeff Calnan. She said, are you sure? And I said, baby, I'm not the same guy that I was 20 years ago. And I picked up that drink in October 1998, and I poured it down. And I don't remember thinking, I hope I don't lose my three kids. I don't remember thinking, I hope I don't burn my life to the ground. I hope I don't lose my career. I hope I don't lose my home. I hope I don't lose my friends. I hope I don't lose my cars and my motorcycles and my self-respect and my dignity and my dreams. But I lost all those things. And I think maybe if I thought about it all, I thought maybe I'll do this for a little while. I just got to get through this moment right now. I just want to be like everybody else. But I'm not like everybody else. And the other thing that those old timers used to say was that if you pick up after a long time of being sober, it's going to be like you never quit. And I never could figure out what kind of weird upside down backwards AA math that was, but they were right about that too. Because the wheels came off in no time. You know, that first night I'm thinking, I just got to keep this cool so that I don't alarm the others. And by the second night, I'm telling her, my fiance's best friend, fiance, that I'm going to knock him out in this nightclub. And things weren't any better at home, and I got arrested in my own house. And I was out there for 2.5 years. And one by one, you came to see me and begged me to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to your rehabs, and I fell off your chairs in your meetings, and I broke your hearts. And after a while, I just gave up. And my daughter, who was 18 years old the first time, she never saw her father take a drink until she was 18 years old. And one night, she came by my house. I'd been out for a couple of years. And I used to be her hero. And she came by my house. And she walked in, and she found me, the door was unlocked, and she found me laying on a sofa with a needle in my arm and an empty vodka bottle, and I was unconscious, and she thought I was dead, so she ran outside and called her best friend, who drove 25 miles from Canyon Country, and she said, please go in there and see if my daddy is alive or dead, because I'm scared. And that's what I do to the people that love me. Once I pick up, there's no getting back. And after 2 years, I just gave up. I knew I was never getting back. And one by one, you'd come to see me and ask me to come back. And one by one, I broke your heart and sent you home in tears. And one by one, you'd say, Jeff, we love you and we'll always love you, but we can't watch you do this. And we'll always pray for you. And we'll always be waiting for you over here, but we can't watch you do this. And only one person kept coming. He was a newcomer. He was too stupid to know better. This guy didn't know Dick. He had a sponsor he hardly ever saw, and he talked to him on the phone. He used to read to him out of the big book, and that was it. And he met me because he was trying to 12-step this other guy who'd since died, who died younger than me. And so this guy would come out every day. He had like 3 months, and he'd come out every day. And one night he's at my house, and he's trying to 12-step me, and he was Israeli, he had this really heavy accent. I can never understand what he was saying at the time anyway. And I'm selling guns because I got no car. I'm in this place I'm about to be evicted out of. I got no car. I got no insurance. I got no money. I got no job. I got nothing. I got a bicycle with 2 flat tires. And I got a bad booze habit and a bad drug habit. And I'm selling guns to get more money to buy more booze. And I was getting this gun ready because I had a big sale going down that night. And I got a round jammed in there, and I couldn't get the bolt back, and I couldn't get the magazine out, and I guess I had my finger on the trigger, and he's standing there telling me that I'm welcome back in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I pull on this bullet, and I guess my finger was on the trigger, because it went pow, 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 like that, and a bullet went right next to his foot, and he looked at that bullet hole, and he said, I gotta go, and then off there. And he jumped in his car, and he drove back over the hill to the Wilshire District as fast as he could. And with trembling hands, he called his sponsor, and he said, I am never going back there. And his sponsor said, why not? And he said, because it's crazy there. I'm either going to get shot or I'm going to get drunk. It's insane. And he said, who's there? And he said, just him. And he told the sponsor, who I've never met, by the way, what happened. And his sponsor thought about that for a second, and he said, Shahar, haven't you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Because the big book says that you can go to the most sordid place on earth on God's errand and have no fear. As long as your motives are right, he will keep you safe. So I want you to get in your car and drive back over the hill and go tell your friend that he is welcome back in Alcoholics Anonymous. By the way, the next line in that book says that your job now is to be on the firing line of life, and homeboy was on the firing line that night. And he did. He came back. And he told me I was welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. And eventually he and another guy introduced me to a guy named Buddy Arnold, and I didn't have a car. And my daughter had to drive me down there, and I was so shot out. I was 50 years old. And I had blood on my shirt and booze on my breath, and I weighed 145 pounds. And And my daughter drove me down there to Buddy's office, and Buddy ran a program for musicians, and he said, you're no musician, and I don't have enough money to help the guys that I want to help. And you look to me like you're 2 days from dead. And then he looked at my daughter, and he called me in his inner office, and he said, you know what, I got no reason to help you, and I don't think you're going to make it. But I can't stand the pain in that little girl's eyes, so I'm going to give you a chance. Can you do this without detox if I get you a bed? And I said, sure. And he said, call me every day. And I called him every day for 9 days. And I drank and I used, and then finally on the ninth day, he said, tomorrow's the day. And on August the 7th, 2001, I went to this place called Cry Help. And I had enough booze, enough drugs in me that I got through most of that first day okay, and I even got a little bit of sleep that night. But I woke up really early the next day, and I was so sick. And I don't mean DT sick, and I don't mean dope sick, but I was both those things. I mean, I was so heart sick. And I was so heartbroken, and I was so alone, and I saw, you know, I could see all the damage that I caused, and I saw all the hurt that I'd done, and I knew that everything was my own fault, and I couldn't put anything between me and that pain anymore. And that was the loneliest, darkest, scariest place I've ever been in my life. And there isn't a man or a room in this, or a woman in this meeting right now that doesn't know what I'm talking about. And in that moment of despair, I think for the first time in my life, I came to comprehend the second step. Because as I laid there, and the only prayer I could manage was, please, I laid on that bed all day and cried, and nobody tried to move me. It came to me that maybe everything in my life was gone. Everybody's gone. Everything is gone. And I had it all. But maybe if I could find some way to feel close to this God we're all talking about, it wouldn't matter if I had a car, didn't have a car. Had a home, didn't have a home. Saw my kids, didn't see my kids. Had a job, didn't have a job. If I could just feel close to him, maybe then I could be okay. And I could have some kind of little bit of happiness that would make me feel all right. And that was my greatest dream when I got out here. And I guess that's what the stories are in the book for, right? So that each one of us can tell how we found God. And that's not to say that I came busting out here and said, where's God? And was devoted to that every day, because life ain't that way. I'm not that way. But I came back out here, and I turned 51 years old right after I got out of there. And on my 51st birthday, my ex-fiance, who I'd set up in this business, she came by with her driver and her Escalade and gave me, she could have bought me, now, I'd set her up in this business, she could have bought me a house, she could have bought me a car. I'm living in this dump. She gave me a goddamn bicycle for my 51st birthday. And it was a lousy bike, too, by the way. It was a beach cruiser. I'm in the San Fernando Valley. It's 104 degrees in the shade. It weighed about 60 pounds. It was bright gold. It had those big white handlebars. I could barely pedal it. And my newcomer plan, after I got out and I started feeling a little better, my newcomer plan was I was going to get her back, and I was going to get my old career back, and I'd get my house back, and I was going to go back to meetings where you guys used to know me, so you'd know that I was sober almost 20 years once, and I knew a little something about AA. But I couldn't ride my bike that far, you know, so I had to go to different meetings. And now I look back, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I had to start all over. I remember being in this meeting. They were in this thing about 6 blocks from the halfway house, and there was a guy there, and they were going to have a 4-step workshop. And this guy, Ronnie G, was breaking it down to some newcomers about the 4-step in this workshop and why they should go. And I interjected into the conversation to say something about the 4-step, and Ronnie looked at me, and he goes, aren't you the guy that got drunk, like, after 20 years? And I said, yeah. And he goes, shut up. And he went back to talking. I got no respect. And I was helping a guy, Mr. Big Shot, I was helping a guy scrub swimming pools for $20 a day and a Jamba Juice, you know, 2 or 3 times a week. That was my money. And I rode this bicycle to that, you know, with that stupid pool thing because I didn't have a car, and I rode that bike to meetings, and I walked to meetings, and people picked me up and took me to meetings. And about 3 months sober, I met a guy named Tommy, and Tommy's my hero. And Tommy was one of those guys, he's like, seeing Tommy is like getting a hug from God, and Tommy came up hard. His whole life he came up hard. Tommy's a product of Skid Row in prisons, but he is the sweetest, kindest, gentlest guy I know. And I just love that guy. And when I was about 3 months sober, I heard him say, I think I'll be measured today by what I do and not by what I say. And I thought about that for days, trying to figure out what that meant for me. And you know what? In 11 and a half years, I have not raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened was I stopped thinking about what I was going to have to say, and I was able to listen to you, and I heard some remarkable people say some remarkable things. I heard a guy named Bob Olson say that the fellowship of the Spirit is not the fellowship of the meeting or the coffee break or the coffee shop or the AA dance. The fellowship of the Spirit is the common bond that grows up around people who share the common experience of working the 12 steps and having a spiritual awakening. I heard a guy named Bill Cleveland say that God lives in the spaces between me and you. And if I want to get close to God, I got to get close to you. And the closer I am to you, the closer I am to God. I heard a guy named Ralph White say that this was the land of starting all over again, where we believe in loving unlovable people and believing in the impossible, and that I was about to plug into a power that could do anything but fail. I heard them and a million other people, and Larry Thomas and all those guys, all my heroes. And I started going to meetings, and I kept my mouth shut, and I started doing this thing, and little by little, I started to put life back together. And I just couldn't seem to get that job thing right. I just couldn't seem to get it back together. I owed the government $100,000. I defaulted on a lawsuit for $47,000. I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't have a car, and I'm trying to put this life back together. Finally, about a year and a half sober, I kind of got a job doing what I used to do, working for people that used to work for me, and I lasted about 6 months, and they fired me. And now I'm 2 years sober, and I'm living with this other gal, and we're talking about getting married, and I'm 2 years sober, and I'm sitting in the Monday night Chapter 12 Men's Stag in Sherman Oaks. And I'm sitting there thinking, when am I ever going to get it back together? I haven't had a drink in 2 years, and I owe the government all this money, and I just can't seem to catch up, and I got three kids, and one of them was going to want to go to college, and the other one's this and that, and I don't know what to do, and maybe I shouldn't get married, and maybe I should go this, and all I can think about, too, is like, you know, when we come back, I came back, and all I could do was cry about all the stuff that I lost, and you guys used to pat me on the ass and say, don't worry, Jeff, you'll get all that stuff back. Well, guess what, newcomers? We just say that crap. We don't really know. And I'm sitting there with my lip out thinking, you lied to me, and I'm not going to get all my stuff back. And you know what? I never did. I didn't get any of that stuff back. But I'm sitting in this meeting, and then I look up at the podium, and in that meeting, there's 110 guys in that meeting, and there's guys there that both belong to the same exclusive country club, and there's guys there that both did time in the shoe at Pelican Bay in solitary confinement. And they mixed there in the way that only happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's 110 guys in that room, and you can hear a pin drop. Because there's a guy at the podium, and his name is Joe. And a few months before this happened, Joey's son, Nicky, was hurt playing football. And he took a hit the wrong way, and he went down, and they called an ambulance. And before they got him to the hospital, he was in a coma. And he lay in that coma for 4.5 months, and he almost died a half a dozen times. And the first person Joey called was another guy from that group. His name was Dave P., and Dave P. called some guys who called some guys who called some gals. And by 9:30 that night, the hospital was full of people from Alcoholics Anonymous. And they weren't there because they're doctors or because they know what to say. They were there in case Joey needed somebody to hold him in the middle of the night. And Joe got so many phone calls from so many people in groups that he's never been to. But people were calling him and sending him cards and talking about him. My sponsor went to Puerto Rico, and Joe got a card from some people in Puerto Rico from a group down there because my sponsor went to a meeting there. And all these people were calling him. He couldn't, so you had to call him. You can't raise your hand that meeting. We called on Joe every week to hear what was happening with Nikki. And I come out of my self-pity, and there's Joe talking about Nikki. And it's this heartbreaking story. And if he lived, he wasn't going to walk. And if he walked, he was never going to talk. And I got to remember to tell the end of this story. And then all of a sudden, Joe looks out in the room at this one guy sitting there. And Joey smiles in the middle of this heartbreaking story. And he says, I want to thank Biff right now. Because before this happened, Biff was just another guy I saw at the meetings. I didn't even know him. But Biff has been there every day. And I love you, Biff. And my family loves you. And I don't know what I would have done without you. And I saw in those two men the man that I wanted to be. And I saw in what they meant to each other and what they did for each other and what they felt for each other that guy that I was looking for. And it's a funny thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. If you get up at the podium and talk about it, nothing happens. But if you make up your mind in your heart of hearts that you are going to be available to people and you're going to give to people and you're going to help them, they show up. And the captains of industry and the golfers and the studio executives never, ever asked me to be their sponsor. I got Brain Damage Larry, Scary Jimmy, On Ramp Rich, Italian Al, Hike the Armenian Gangster. Those are my guys. Billy the Convict. I got another job, and I had an assistant at work. He was this real straight arrow from Ohio State. He was working for me. And these guys used to call me, and, you know, Big Spanky from White Fence shows up in your office. And he used to call me the convict whisperer behind my back. And one day, this guy named Billy the Convict calls me, and Billy calls me and says, I got this guy named Phil. He's right out of Pelican Bay. He needs a sponsor. You're perfect for him. And I'm driving out to PIP thinking, why am I perfect for Phil? You know, and I get out there, and I don't know Phil, and I go to the front desk, and I said, I'm looking for Phil. And they go, Phil's in the TV room. And I go in there, and there's 30, 40 guys in the TV room. But there's one guy sitting there, and he's got a big swastika peeking out from underneath his white beater undershirt. It says, love thy race on the back of his neck. He's got a widow's peak tattooed on his forehead. He's got these big old arms, and he just looks pissed off. So I go over and I go, you must be Phil. And he said, yeah. And I gave him the AA interview, and I said, have you ever been to a meeting? And he said, no, I couldn't go. And I said, not in the joint? And he said, nope, they wouldn't let me go. And I said, you know, that's weird, because I know guys doing life in CMC, and they go every Friday. And he said, not in the shoe, you can't go. And I thought, okay, solitary confinement, maybe 60, 90 days tops. I said, okay, tough guy, how long were you in the shoe? 2.5 years. So I said, okay, tell me your story. And he did. And you know what? Phil should have been locked up in that thing for 2.5 years. And in there, he's a force to be reckoned with, and he's a shot caller. And he's good at it. It's his whole life. It's all he knows. And when he was done telling me his story, I said, you know, I don't know anything about all that, but here's what I know. If I'm going to be your sponsor, I'm going to do you like mine did me. And that means we're going to open the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to read through it. And when it tells you to make a decision, you're going to make it. When it tells you to do something, you're going to do it. And the first time you don't, I'm not your sponsor. How's that sound? And he said, I'm willing to do anything as long as I don't have to go back to prison. And you know, there's some rooms where that's not a good enough answer. And I hear things, I've heard Bill Cleveland talk about this, I hear things and I form opinions based on stuff that I hear, like we got trick answers and trick questions, you know, like are you done and all that bullshit. So, and I call Bob Olson because I'm confused about this one. And I call Bob Olson, I said, Bob, what do you think about this answer? I just don't want to go back to prison. I don't know if that's a good enough answer. And he just laughed at me. He said, how do you know what the right answer is? All you know is that one of God's sons named Billy called you because he has another son named Phil. And Phil's in trouble and he might not make it without your help, and that's all you need to know. So you're Phil's sponsor. So I became Phil's sponsor, and I tried to do like the book says. I tried to tell him in advance what we were going to do. The book says, tell, you know, your prospect exactly what we're going to do, what's expected, outline the whole thing. And I picked him up to go do his third step. I'm going to take him to this little 24-hour chapel. And we're driving along, and I realize that I have neglected to tell Nazi lowrider Phil that we're going to be kneeling down, holding hands, and reading a prayer to a God that he doesn't believe in. And I'm trying to find a way to work that into the conversation. And finally, we get there, and he said, what are we doing? And I said, you're not going to believe this. But long story short, we went in there and we knelt down and we opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and we read about the third step. And we held hands and he read a prayer aloud to a God he doesn't believe in. And when he walked out of that little chapel, he had something he didn't have when he walked in there. He had a chance. And on December 17th of that same year, he called me and he said, Sponce, I got a year today. And next week, I got permission from my parole officer, and I'm going to fly to Tennessee because my mother has a new life and a new husband. And I've never been to Tennessee, and I haven't seen my mom in 14 years. And I'm scared. And so we talked it over, and I promised I'd call him on Christmas Day. And on Christmas Day, I called him. And I'm standing out in my backyard by myself. And I'm talking to him, and I ask him, how is it going with moms? And he said, it's okay, it's a little dicey, but it's all right. And I said, "How's your mom holding up?" And he said, "Hold on." And I'd never spoken to this lady in my life, and she gets on the phone, and we make a little small talk about it being Christmas and about the weather in Tennessee. And then she said, "You know, I waited 14 years for this day, and this is the greatest Christmas present I ever could have gotten. And I want to thank you and your friends for what you did for my son." And then I knew. And then I knew how Biff and Joe felt. And then I knew, I think for the first time in my life, what it felt like to be close to God, because I felt close to Phil, because I did something without any expectation and no reward. And it was the greatest feeling I've ever had in my life. I don't remember what a spiritual experience felt like in those other years. It really doesn't matter, because those years are gone. I hear people that go out and they come back, and good, well-meaning people tell them, "You know what, Louis, you didn't really lose those 9 years." "Yes, you did, Louis. They're gone. They're never coming back." "They aren't worth a tinker's damn. They don't mean shit." But I know what they feel like today, and it's almost always when I'm with you or when I'm with my friend Tommy. When I've driven 4.5 hours to speak in a prison, been turned away at the gate, and driven 4.5 hours home, and stood in the parking lot saying goodbye to you, and that feeling comes over me, and I can feel every heartache and every happiness I've ever known in my life in a single moment, and the tears just run down my face, and I am filled to overflowing with gratitude, because I know everything's in the right place. That's when I feel close to God, when I'm with you. And it reaches out into other parts of my life. And when my mom passed away a couple years ago, and that's why I'm not scared about my dad's thing. I'm not upset. I just want to be there for my sister, and I want to be there when he passes. But I found out when my mom was going, I had an experience where I was driving home from their place, and this feeling of calm came over me. And then that gratitude and that, all those feelings come up, and the tears started running down my face again. And I knew right here where I live that everything really was in perfect order. And I knew, and this is the greatest secret of all, that for me, I found out that every unhappiness and every unfortunate turn of events, every kick down, every disappointment is another chance for me to get closer to God. Because that's when I fall down in his arms, put my arms around his knees and say, "I give up. Show me what you want me to do." And that's when those biggest miracles are revealed for me. I didn't come here to say that I'm great. I didn't come here to say that I'm working a great program, because I don't. That's the truth. I came here to say that Alcoholics Anonymous is great. I came here to say that you're great. And I came here to say that God is great. And I keep having these experiences where I meet you people in different places around the world and around the country. And I'm a speaker stalker, and I'm that guy, Bob Olson. I stalked that guy for 2 years till I manipulated the guy into inviting him to be at this retreat, because I knew that guy had something I didn't have. And I was talking to him, and he told me about experience he had. And this is, I got to talk about this, and then I'll get off. Am I done? This guy, at 28 years sober, he had this experience where he just said, you know, he'd written a lot of inventories, and he'd taken a lot of people through the steps, and he'd done all this work. This guy is like the Taliban of AA. He is no bullshit. And he's just not growing. And I'm looking at him, and I'm seeing somebody who's living on a higher plane, and I want to feel like that. I want to know what he knows. I want to be able to do for people what he does for people. And so I spent the weekend with him, and he told me about this experience where and he was praying and meditating. And if you know Bob, Bob is not a guy who hears voices. And Bob heard a voice. Because Bob is asking God, "Why can't I seem to grow anymore? Haven't I done enough inventories? Haven't I helped enough people?" And the voice came back, "It's principles, Bob." And he said, "What are principles?" And he told me the story. And principles are negative things that I believe about myself that are so deeply ingrained I don't even challenge them anymore. And they affect every decision that I make. Things like, "If you really knew me, you wouldn't like me." It's one thing to stand up here and be in the limelight and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, but living the program and talking about it are two different things. "If you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. On the outside, I can act tough, but on the inside, I'm terrified. I'm good enough to get here, but I'm not good enough to get there." And they affect my... And he told me, "You write an inventory about it." And I had to write those things down. "If you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. What's the cause of that? What am I thinking?" And I did a 4-column inventory. And he said, what does it affect? Does it affect your self-esteem? Of course it does. Does it affect your ambitions? Why would I try? I know I'm never good enough for that or for her or for this or for that. And when we were done, he told me to go back to my room at the retreat and put the book, I mean, he's really out of, put the book up on the shelf, because that's what it says, take the book down from the shelf, contemplate it for something like an hour, and then if you think the road is clear, get down on your knees and turn it over. And then I asked him, what about amends? We did 7, what about 8, 9? And he said, I have a younger wife. And he said, I want you to go home and do this. And this is what I did. I went home on Sunday night, and I took my wife, Laura, by the hand, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, honey, I know that sometimes you watch me and you worry, but I want you to know that I did some work this weekend, and I found out some things about myself that were holding me back from being the person that God wants me to be and doing the things that God wants me to do. And I was able to let those things go. And I promise you that from this day forward, we are going to live life like it's an adventure. And she looked at me like I was on fire. You know? Her mouth was hanging open. But you know what? That was 5 years ago. And we haven't had a fight since that day. And we live life like it's an adventure. And that doesn't mean that we're going to go to Borneo next week or go on an archaeological dig. It means that I am able to live life without fear. I had to start my life all over again. I was penniless at 51 years old. I didn't know what I was going to do. I'm 62 years old now. I still don't know how it's going to end up, but I don't have any fear about it. We live in a house that's full of love. It's me and her and my dog. And I see all three of my kids, and our life is full. And I get to come to places like this and meet people like you that touch my heart and change me forever. You know, my favorite thing in AA that I've ever heard a speaker do is my friend Ralph White. Because Ralph does this, when he gets to the meeting when it's like this, and Ralph does this thing where he starts way back here and he starts talking softer and softer and softer and softer until it gets to the very end. And it gets really quiet, and then he goes, shh, you hear that? That's God. He's telling you everything's going to be okay as long as we have each other. God bless you. Thanks for having me.